Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for you planned today. I have three guests, Joshua Sabaka, Justine Lindemann, and Antonio Roman Alcala. They are all contributors to this wonderful new book, A Recipe for Gentrification. And they'll be joining me in just a little bit to really talk about what happens with gentrification when people from a higher socioeconomic, predominantly white community start coming into a predominantly, a community that's predominantly lived in by people of color, and what happens? And, you know, how does that happen? And how do the people that are originally living there get kind of squeezed out? And, you know, it's going to make a great conversation. So I'm really excited to have them on. But before they come on, I want to talk with all of you about some things going on in around the news, some ways that you can take action, and of course, share my weekly recipe with you. So first, ways to take action. I would like to encourage everybody to sign on to this petition that the Organic Consumers Association has put out. And I have a link to it on my website under Take Action. It's a ban for banning the toxic pesticides. And Michael Reagan, who is the new EPA administrator, has the power to restrict a lot of these dangerous pesticides and bring this, make this ban a reality. And also Tom Vilsack, we need to let him do, you know how we feel, and hopefully he can do a better job than he did under the Obama administration. You know, he has his hands tied with the biotech companies, and we really need to get all these lobbyists out of the system and, you know, make choices that are better for the people and the planet, not better for business. So please sign on to that petition. We also are asking Congress to do the proper testing to make sure that fake meat is safe. Right now, the Impossible Foods burger that's come out is filled with some genetic engineered products. You know, that's what makes it look like it's bleeding, is this fake GMO process. And we want to have them test it. I mean, the truth is they really haven't even tested GMOs adequately. So often we just rely on industries doing their own testing, and that's just not good enough. So, you know, the old saying, the fox guarding the chicken hoop, it just doesn't work. We need a third party doing the testing. And so there's a petition to ask Congress to please do that. And lastly, in my take action is a week of action for the People's Climate Movement. And that's coming up the first week of April, starting Monday, April 5th. And there's a whole slew of actions that you can take place to participate in this, but they are really trying to push New York State to pass the Climate and Community Investment Act and also the National Thrive Act. Both really important movements. And there's lots of activities that will be going on throughout the week. And I have those posted on my website at IE Green. So please check those out. So important that we all take action. And this year, you know, during the pandemic, we have not really been able to gather so much. So much of the actions have had to take a virtual Zoom modality. And we really are looking forward to the spring and being able to get out again and really do some lobbying in small groups, you know, still following safety protocols, wearing masks and doing that. But we need to show up. We need to show up. We need to push for better policies. And it starts, you know, in the local area. So start with your local movements and join in and surround yourself with other people that are also caring. That's one way to really stay protect yourself from getting depressed by all the problems that we have, is if you surround yourself with other people that are also looking at these problems and taking them seriously, you have camaraderie and you have community and you don't feel alone in it, and you can feel uplifted because there's so many other people that care. So we all need to show up and do our part. This week in news, I wrote about plant-based diets and how they're gaining momentum. And it's really an exciting time in the food movement. plant-based foods are actually the fastest growing segment of the food industry, so I've been told. And I have some statistics here. I mean, I think they said that in 2019, The Economist declared 2019 is the year of the vegan. And in a new study, 9.7 million Americans are following a vegan diet. That's up 300% from 15 years ago. I know I have been a vegetarian for over 40 years, although then I was a pescatarian for a while, eating fish. But I was a vegetarian. I ate dairy. And honestly, I love dairy. Who wouldn't? It's so good. But it's not good for our bodies. And the production of it is not good for the planet. So, you know, I'm not one to, you know, be dogmatic about diets. I know everybody has to follow what personally feels right for their own bodies. But I think we all need to think about the global imprint that the production of meat and dairy has on the planet and do our part in reducing our intake so that we don't monopolize so much of the production. We need to share it with the rest of the planet. And we also need to support those that are doing it in a way that is not harming the planet. And there are good ways of doing it. You know, we've all been hearing about regenerative agriculture as opposed to the industrial agricultural system that our country supports. So check that out. And please, you know, think about your food choices. Think about ways that you can reduce your carbon footprint by making better food choices. And anyway, so I've just been really enjoying experimenting with new foods, cooking new foods this year. You know, I did a fully vegan Passover, which was my first. And it was really exciting. I made a mock gefilte fish. That recipe's on my website, using seaweed to give a little bit of that fishy flavor. Using flaxseed to hold it together. Really, it came out great. And of course, really, gefilte fish is really just a source of ingesting horseradish, lots of good horseradish. So it really satisfied that. So check out those recipes. And today I'll be sharing my stuffed cabbage recipe with you, which is the main course that I did for our Passover Seder. And again, my Passover Seder, we didn't really come together with my family, still kind of keeping our distance, but we did have a virtual Seder, which was lovely. And I did cater a vegan Seder for a local family, which was also lovely and was a great excuse for me to make all the foods that I love. So anyway, this stuffed cabbage recipe I'd like to share with you now. I used a Savoy cabbage, which is the cabbage that has a little bit of a curly leaf to it as opposed to just a flat leaf. And you know, and it worked out really well. But you can also use the regular white cabbage or even a Napa cabbage. You can even make this recipe and roll it in collard greens or Swiss chard if you'd like, really whatever you have. But I use cabbage for this. So the filling, filled with lots of delicious vegetables and lentils and rice. I used one onion diced, one celery diced, one pepper diced, one zucchini diced. And all of the dices are pretty small. I'd say like, you know, a half inch. The onion and the carrots were a little smaller because they're harder and they take longer to cook. I used one long Japanese eggplant that I also diced up, two yellow squash, one to two carrots depending on the size of them, three portobello mushrooms that I diced up, one small head of broccoli that I cut into really small florets. Remember that this is what we're making is a filling, so you don't want any large pieces. You want the whole filling to be able to come together to be stuffed. Two teaspoons of salt, two tablespoons of fresh chopped dill, and if you like dill, you can even go three tablespoons. You know, I just love that flavor. A half a teaspoon pepper and two cups of fresh French lentils. And two cups of cooked brown rice, two tablespoons of tamari, which is a soy sauce that's gluten-free, and a quarter cup of red wine. And I started by sauteing the filling in a wok, the onions in olive oil until translucent. Then I added the celery, the carrots, and cooked those for a few minutes, added the eggplant and cooked those until they were soft. Then I added a tablespoon or two of water if you sense that the vegetables are sticking to the wok, as opposed to adding more oil. You know, I'm really trying to cut down on how much oil I use as well. So then I added the mushrooms and cooked those down until they were soft. Then I added the red wine and the tamari, which added some more liquid to the dish and helped steam all the rest of the vegetables that I added, the zucchini, the yellow squash, the peppers, and the broccoli, and just let those cook until all the vegetables get soft. You're going to add all the herbs, the salt and pepper, and then at the very end, you add the lentils and rice and mix it up thoroughly. And you can keep that warm, let it cook down so that, the lentils and the rice take up the flavor, and taste it. You can add more tamari, more salt and pepper, more dill if you like. Everybody's different. If you want to make it spicy, you can also add some hot pepper flakes to that. But anyway, let that sit to the side. You want to take the large head of cabbage, and you're going to cut out the core of that. You're going to bring a large pot of water to a boil, and you're going to immerse the cabbage in the water for about 10 minutes. And then you're going to remove that and separate out the larger outer leaves. If you can't find a large cabbage, which I couldn't, I found two smaller ones, and I immersed those in the water, and that worked as well. The cabbage tends to want to float, so I actually put like a lid that was smaller than the pot on top and put a Pyrex measuring cup on top of that to kind of weight down the cabbage so that they stayed underneath the water. And then I remove them, let them cool, then, you know, separated out the leaves. For the sauce, what you need is 1 14-ounce can of crushed tomatoes, 3 14-ounce cans of diced tomatoes, 3 onions cut into slivers and then cut the slivers into half, 1/4 cup of agave, or you could use honey if you're, you know, I was cooking this for a vegan family, so honey for many vegans is not an acceptable sweetener, so I used agave, but you could use honey. You could even use maple syrup, although maple syrup has a stronger flavor that you may not want. 1/2 cup of raisins, 1/2 cup of red wine vinegar, 1.5 teaspoons of salt, 4 tablespoons of pine nuts, and 2 teaspoons of cinnamon. And so for the sauce, you're first going to cook down the onions in the olive oil over medium heat until they're translucent. Add the pine nuts and let those cook until they get a little toasted and golden brown. Then add the cinnamon and cook that. And that just brings out the flavor in the cinnamon as well. Then add all the remaining ingredients, bring it to a boil, and let it reduce in a simmer for about 30 minutes, stirring constantly so it doesn't stick. But the sauce will really get thicker and cook down quite a bit. I didn't say adding the water. You have to add 3/4 cups of water to that. I'm missing that in the recipe. I have to add that. And then let that cook down. And then to fill the cabbage, you're going to take those larger outer leaves. You're going to take a couple spoonfuls of the filling into the cabbage and carefully roll it up. You're going to spray the casserole pan, whatever size you're using, casserole pan, spray with a little oil, and then put a couple scoops of the sauce into the pan on the bottom. And then you're going to roll up the cabbages and line them up seam side down in the casserole pan, then cover it with the sauce and bake it in the oven for about 30 minutes or 40 minutes until it's really boiling and takes on the flavor. And that's it. It cooks up really wonderfully. It's delicious. And just trying to see the recipe with the, 1/2 cup of water. It's missing here. 1/2 cup of water is, and you're gonna add to the sauce. And that's it. So I hope you all get a chance to make that. It's so delicious, and it really was a wonderful main course for our Passover Seder. And now I would like to introduce all of you to my guests for the week so we can talk about their book, A Recipe for Gentrification, Food, Power, and the Resistance in the City. And the first guest is Joshua Sabika, and forgive me if I'm pronouncing your last name incorrectly. You can correct me. He's the associate professor of sociology at Colorado State University, And as an educator and scholar activist, he ties his work to grassroots initiatives to advance food system change and economic and racial justice. His research and teaching engage with food as a site of economic, political, and social struggle. His recent work focuses on food systems and cultures and social movements at intersections of gentrification and racial capitalism. Underlying these interests is an ongoing engagement with how activists and scholars articulate and practice food justice and what this means for building broad-based social movements. He's the author of Food Justice Now, Deepening the Roots of Social Struggle. He's also the co-editor with Allison Hope Alkin and Yuki Kato of Recipe for Gentrification, Food, Power, and Resistance in the City. Justine Lindemann is an assistant professor of community development and resilience at Penn State University's College of Agricultural Sciences. She has several years of experience working on issues around community and economic development, both domestically and internationally. Her teaching focuses on methods, theories, and practices of community development with particular focus on civic engagement and anti-racist praxis. She also has a faculty extension appointment that guides an applied research and programming agenda on issues related to urban food systems, equity in the food system, and urban community resilience more broadly. Prior to coming to Penn State, Justine spent several years researching experiences and politics of vacant land reuse and urban agriculture among Black gardeners and farmers in Cleveland, Ohio. And lastly, Antonio Roman Alcala is an educator, researcher, writer, and organizer based in San Francisco, California, who has worked for Just Sustainable Food Systems for over 15 years. Antonio co-founded San Francisco's Alameny Farm, San Francisco's Urban Agriculture Alliance, and the California Food Policy Council. And his 2010 documentary film, In Search of Good Food, can be viewed free online. He holds a BA from UC Berkeley and is a PhD candidate at the International Institute of Social Studies in The Hague. Currently, Antonio teaches at UC Santa Cruz and with the Urban Permaculture Institute, maintains the blog antidogmatist.com, conducts research on agroecology, social movements, and social change, and co-facilitates the scholar information at Agroecology Research Action Collective. He also participates in and supports a variety of social movement projects, including urban farms, tenant councils, rural agroecology, educational collaboratives, and the U.S. Food Sovereignty Alliance. And welcome, everybody. I'm so glad to have you all here. Thank you so much
for having us.
Sure. So I thought I could start with asking each of you separately how your work as scholars and activists engage with food gentrification, and just give each of you know give my listeners a little background. And maybe Justine, we can start with you.
Sure. So a lot of my recent work is focused more closely on urban community resilience. And, you know, there's a lot of definitions of resilience out there. And the way that I think about urban community resilience is the capacity for community relationships and networks to change over time through processes of collective learning as they respond and adapt to crises and disturbances or shocks to various urban systems. And so food gentrification can be seen as either an acute or a chronic disturbance within urban community systems. And I think that working with communities to be resilient to those disturbances really is crucial. So right now, as part of my work with Penn State University and with Penn State Extension, I'm leading a narrative inquiry project in cities across Pennsylvania that is examining translational research practices between and among community partners, cooperative extension, and the university. And so translational research is about the way that I think about translational research is a reciprocal relationship between communities and university professionals to engage in multiple knowledge systems, to utilize both community knowledge and wisdom and the university knowledge and expertise and how that can be mutually beneficial. And we're also beginning a collaboration in the Mon Valley, which is an area southeast of Pittsburgh, to explore how communities can access and participate in food and income support programs within the larger food system. And so overall, I think that supporting communities to take a more active role in determining what their food system looks like, I think is really crucial to pushing back against some of the negative impacts of food gentrification.
Thank you. Thank you. Josh?
I guess I would start with a story. So when I was a budding food justice scholar and activist, I was participating in an allyship, is what it was called, with an organization called People's Grocery in West Oakland, California. And at that time period, so first just taking a step back, West Oakland is a historically Black, historically working class community. And it's a community that had been structurally disinvested for decades and decades. It was a community that was redlined, so a place that banks refused to lend to residents in that community. It was also a place where there is high levels of pollution. It's surrounded by freeways. So it was a place experiencing a lot of structural inequalities. And this food justice organization was working to increase access to healthy and affordable food that was in alignment with the cultural foods of the African-American community historically living there. And I remember speaking with an organizer for that organization, and they were talking about how they were concerned that gentrification was going to happen in that community. It was the last stop on the BART line before San Francisco, and that they were concerned artists and other kinds of foodies would start moving into that space. At that time period, you might not have guessed it, just given sort of the actual demographics and kind of physical geography of that community. But then, you know, in a very short period of time, in 15 years, what we have seen is really an inversion of the demographics. It is now, you know, roughly 30-35% white, where, you know, at that time period it was closer to maybe 5-10% white. And the cost of housing in that neighborhood has skyrocketed. And in the same time period, there's been an increase in things like food cooperatives, bakeries, and other kinds of food amenities, if you will, but not until fairly recently, a full-scale grocery store, which People's Grocery had been fighting for many, many years. And for me, it really opened my eyes to these kinds of intersections between food and gentrification, which is really at the heart of this edited volume, A Recipe for Gentrification. And this has been a project that's required a lot of different minds. You know, there's over 22 authors, most of whom are untenured or graduate students, as well as many activists, scholars included. And so I think that project in and of itself highlights these kinds of intersections that are taking place across the United States, from hyper gentrifying places like San Francisco and Denver to places less associated with gentrification like Oklahoma City and Durham, North Carolina. And so that project, I think, has been really important, both for just building community around this topic and also raising awareness about what's taking place and how activists are trying to fight back and or are struggling in the process of fighting back. And so that's been a project that's taken up a lot of my time over the past couple of years. And, you know, I can get into my work in Denver, Colorado as well, perhaps as this conversation unfolds.
Thank you. And Antonio, how'd you get into this?
Well, I guess I would start by saying, you know, my connection to food gentrification begins personally rather than at a scholarly level. So I'm actually born and raised in San Francisco, which many people know as one of the most gentrifying and gentrified places in the U.S. And so I grew up here and was definitely part of the Mission District music and arts scene in the 90s. And basically saw a lot of the effects of gentrification happening during the first dot-com wave in the late 90s, and became very active in the Mission Anti-Displacement Coalition and a lot of other local formations that were seeking to push back against the displacement happening. And from that really exposed me to a lot of these dynamics that we tend to hear about around the role of artists and sort of, you know, being the spear tip into gentrification, or the ideas of sort of the cultural aspects of gentrification. But so for me, it's really personal, just seeing as you know, basically everyone I grew up with is no longer living in San Francisco or lives with their parents. If their parents were lucky enough to buy a home before it became super expensive, or live in rent controlled apartments, which are few and far between, but do exist still. And so food stuff kind of came into my life a little bit later on in the mid 2000s. I started getting involved in organizing around food. I helped start this the urban farm, as you mentioned, Alamany Farm, which is very close to where I grew up. And so I started getting involved more on the food side of things. And it was really sort of the combination of these experiences that led to my interest in thinking about sort of contributing to this book and thinking about how food and gentrification are intertwined. And I will say that, like, you know, it's, to me, I look at a lot of different social political issues in a similar way, you know, as issues of control, power, culture, and also at their root, issues of capitalism and the way capitalism structures our options, especially politically. And so I don't really see sort of food and gentrification as necessarily two separate issues that happen to intersect, but both two sort of fundamentally similar, arenas of struggle, arenas of power imbalances, that we see similar sort of processes at play. And of course they overlap in various concrete ways, but it also just helps me think about them in terms of being things that we can actively work against, rather than having a sort of, I think there's a little bit of like fatalism when it comes to gentrification these days. And so I think that both the way our food system exists and the way our housing and land control and usage systems exist are not sort of just there and happen to be there. They are the products of struggle, and we can actually shift how they operate.
Yeah. You know, gentrification, I mean, I'm in New York, and so I have seen it, you know, play out so much. I went to art school, and all my artist friends, I mean, they lived in Williamsburg, they lived on the Lower East Side. Soho was already, you know, already had started. So Soho wasn't affordable when I graduated college as an artist, but the Lower East Side and, you know, and even Harlem, I mean, that, you know, they were dangerous places. They were, you know, it was in the 70s, you know, you didn't even want to ride the subway. And, you know, seeing how they have changed over time and how they're totally not affordable for any of my artist friends anymore. It's just, you know, it plays out in every city across the country. So this is a great conversation. Do you find it more useful to concentrate your analysis on the cultural aspect of gentrification and food, the political aspect, or a combination of both? And maybe all of you can answer this, but Antonio, while you're up on screen, why don't you take this first?
I did want to address this because I sort of was alluding to it earlier that in my experience, there's this phenomenon of the way gentrification is discussed often has a lot of emphasis on the cultural aspects of it. So we talk about, oh, it's, you know, these artists who are bohemians and they move into a low rent area. And then because of their flourishing of various kinds of cultural outputs and their interests in different kinds of foods and whatnot, that's what sort of brings capital into these disinvested zones and sort of causes gentrification to happen. So basically I've seen a lot of blame directed, especially towards sort of what we think of as the more privileged underclasses, right? So artists, activist types, people who are able to dedicate their lives or choose to dedicate their lives to things other than just the pursuit of personal wealth and capital. Those are the kinds of people who tend to be blamed in these cultural descriptions. And that transfers to today, where now there's more of this, you know, there used to be the term yuppies in the 80s, and now there's like techies, and there's other people of wealth. And as you mentioned, they tend to be skewed white, although it's not just a purely kind of white as skin color phenomenon, right? It really is about economic class, that these people come with their own cultural attributes as well. Oh, they really like, you know, avocado toast or whatever is the thing that these people like that differs from what the people who originally lived in a gentrifying neighborhood liked. And I think that this focus on the cultural aspects is very problematic in that I mean, it's obviously a reality. These are real dynamics, and they deserve some unpacking, and issues of cultural appropriation and all this kind of stuff come into there. But I think we lose out if we forget that gentrification is fundamentally a political economic process that is driven by economic and political elites. Those are the people who create the conditions for gentrification with their actions. And to blame the sort of essentially the consumer side, right, the people who choose to buy what because they can buy. I mean, certainly there's a class dynamic happening, right? Anytime you have richer people choosing things, like, that has power over poorer people who don't have that access to choice. That's a difference, right? But that's not the same thing as saying there's actually choices being made by investors as to how things get invested in or disinvested in, that really lay the foundation for what you know, the scholar Neil Smith called the rent gap, which is essentially why gentrification happens, is because there's an opportunity to profit from the difference between what rents are currently being charged and what rents could be charged. And that fundamentally, the search for profit is what drives, I don't know what the percentage is, but it's a huge majority of development, urban development especially, right? There's a small amount of sort of nonprofit, you know, affordable housing development that does exist, at least here in San Francisco, but it's a very small percentage. And basically what we're talking about are processes driven by private capital and enablers of that process in city, local, state, and federal government. And so to blame, sort of focus on the cultural aspects, I think distracts us from the foundation of what gentrification is, and therefore distracts us from seeking what the actual solutions might be.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Justine. I think this is a really, really important point. And I just wanted to build on one thing here. And, you know, I started with the story in West Oakland to talk about the initial stage of disinvestment and structural discrimination. And this gets to the political economic dimensions that Antonio is referring to. And if we look at another example that I'm familiar with in Denver, you know, a neighborhood called Five Points, it's another historically Black and working class community. This is a place that was also redlined. It's also a place where blockbusting took place. And there was a particular site in Curtis Park that was historically affordable housing that for decades provided lots of places for people to live in that neighborhood. It was demolished and then it sat vacant for a long time. And it was acquired by Denver Housing Authority, which is a quasi-municipal corporation, supposedly charged with increasing affordable housing. But what it did in this instance is land bank that property, allow urban farmers 5 years to farm on that land, sort of as a means to wait until the sort of impacts of the Great Recession receded, and then found a wealthy developer to build new housing on that site that appealed to wealthier people. And this is sort of the structural piece, I think, that Antonio is referring to. And it's important to see how investors and how politicians and how other people in what Harvey Mollett refers to as the growth machine perpetuate gentrification that appeals to tastes and appeals to culture, but that it's an interaction, and that if we lose sight of the structural piece, we're not really going to be able to adequately stop gentrification.
Thanks. Justine?
Yeah. And you know, what Josh was saying about the policies and practices around land and how that integrates and articulates with current political economies, I think is so important to pay attention to. A lot of my work, like you mentioned, Bhavani, has been in Cleveland, Ohio. And, you know, Cleveland, for people who aren't really familiar with it, is a city that has followed a lot of the similar patterns as places like Detroit and Pittsburgh, where it's lost a lot of population. There's been an exodus of industry, a disciplining of the labor class, really powerful forces of white flight out of the city. And the city currently has somewhere between 3,500 and 4,000 acres of vacant land. But there is this persistent paradigm and dedication to that growth mentality and to the promise of redevelopment of the city. And so through processes of land banking and investment coming in and buying up large swaths of vacant land, people no longer have access to that land for things like growing food and for, you know, producing more self-determined urban food systems. And so I think that, you know, thinking about both the cultural and the political as sort of interrelated processes is really important when it comes to understanding gentrification and how that impacts spaces that are both raced and classed across cities. I once heard somebody talk about gentrification as the urgency, this perceived feeling of urgency to improve or upgrade a neighborhood because of the people who live there. But it really is an urgency to extract more profits or rents, like Antonio was saying, from those spaces because of the people who live there. And you know, that urgency to improve a space, to provide more amenities, to provide more comprehensive food systems and more comprehensive food access exists in spaces that are predominantly white and have the potential to be more profitable to investors and to developers, whereas that urgency does not exist in spaces that are low income, communities of color, spaces that are seen as maybe unchanging or unchangeable from the way that they currently are. And, you know, the way that low-income neighborhoods, or the characteristics of low-income neighborhoods are often, can often be attributed to some of these structural and systemic issues such as redlining, disinvestment, white flight, and the exodus of industry and jobs, like I mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm. Antonio, what is the role of urban and rural, or the divides between them, in the ways we think about and talk about gentrification? So what are those roles?
Mm-hmm. Well, definitely, you know, we saw with the entirety of the Trump era, Trump's election to just recently, you know, there's a trope in our society that basically ascribes sort of conservative, let's say right-wing politics to the rural landscape and rural peoples, and assumes a sort of progressiveness to urban spaces, right? I think a lot of us who live those coastal elites, you know, and there's a reality to the sort of mutual othering that happens, right? Where Fox News is encouraging people in middle America to see urban people as their enemy, and vice versa. In a lot of ways, we have a lot of demonizing of rural peoples in the rural landscape. And it's, of course, assumed that the rural means white, which is also not true, really. So I think this is important because we have this sort of dichotomy which needs to be taken apart, and gentrification allows us to see that actually racism is very present and actively enacted right now in urban spaces by urban people. And if we think about it at a global level, the sort of white supremacy that comes with US hegemony and imperialism around the world, we can see that the centers of white supremacist power are finance, law, banking, policy, which are all centered in urban spaces. So this sort of this dichotomy or way we think of urban and rural as being these two separate places with very different sorts of politics, I think needs to be questioned a little bit more. And on a sort of the more positive side of that is to recognize that it's not positive that gentrification is a reality in both places, but to recognize that these classed and raced dynamics of gentrification also are imposed upon working class people in both spaces, right? That there is rural gentrification and evictions of people as an epidemic in the rural landscape, just like it's happening in urban places. We tend to talk about gentrification in urban terms, but it's not actually limited to urban spaces. And so I think that, you know, similarly, you know, obviously coming from an urban agriculturist's background and interest, you know, a big issue for urban ag is to find access to land and sort of secure access to land, right? That's no different than what a lot of young farmers are facing in the rural landscape. And it's because of, if not gentrification, I mean, here in California, farmland is very expensive. It is actually still this class dynamic of what happens when you have hyper consolidation of wealth, which is allowed again through policy. You know, what happens when that happens is these forms of exclusion and displacement and non-security of place. And so I think that there's a way which gentrification and talking about it and expanding outside of the urban alone allows us to see more points of solidarity, essentially, and points of connection between urban and rural. So we stop thinking of it as sort of separate spaces of separate kinds of struggles.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sitting here and I'm listening to everything you're saying, and I'm also, you know, from my own experiences, knowing a lot of people that have moved into areas that were that they were able to afford because they were a lower income area, and then seeing that the prices of their apartments have gone up and that, you know, a new coffee shop has come in, and, you know, everyone's all happy about that. The people that have bought those, you know, is there any side to gentrification that you would say is positive, or is it all negative? You know, I mean, I would, you know, from an outsider perspective, it also, you know, sometimes makes the neighborhood safer, you know, crime can go down, more transportation can come into the area, you know, a supermarket will come in that wasn't there before, so that people will have access to healthier food that didn't have access to it. So does everyone hate the gentrification that happens in the area, or is there a positive side to it?
I want to let the other two give a more substantial response to this, but I guess the only thing I would say is, for me, immediately what comes to mind is just distinguishing between particular outcomes of gentrification and the processes of gentrification and what causes them. That we can appreciate particular things that happen. Like, I love fancy coffee. Fancy coffee is much better than 7-Eleven coffee. I will not deny it. But, you know, that's different. That's a different issue than what might have brought that coffee into my neighborhood. And saying that because I like the coffee, that processes must be good. I think in fact it's largely that we will be deceived if we just take these sort of elements we like out of gentrification and forget what's happening behind the scenes, essentially. Mm-hmm. But yeah, maybe Josh or Justine have a more substantial answer than that.
Glenn, I would just add to what Antonio has said, that the process of gentrification, I think embedded in that question is the question of for whom and by whom. Because I don't think that there's nothing wrong with improving safety of a neighborhood. There's nothing wrong with adding amenities that community members can access within a neighborhood. You know, having choices of where to buy coffee, what kind of coffee to buy, or, you know, whether or not you want to get food from a co-op or you want to get food from, you know, a Whole Foods. But the questions that come to my mind are, who has access to those amenities and who made the decision about which amenities are being installed in particular neighborhoods, to whose benefit and to whose detriment. I used to live in Washington, D.C., and I lived in a neighborhood that was, over the course of the years that I lived there and after I left the city, was being quite violently gentrified. And when I first moved into that area, it was a predominantly Salvadorian neighborhood. You know, I lived in the basement of a house that one of my colleagues owned. And over the course of the time that I was there, a Target was put in, a Best Buy was put in, a Washington Sports Club, condos, apartment complexes, bougie restaurants. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you slowly start to see the Salvadorian food options at the grocery stores disappear. You slowly start to see the mom and pop Salvadorian restaurants no longer be able to afford the rent in the buildings that they had previously occupied. And so while a lot of these amenities might be really great, you know, it's nice to be able to do some shopping at a Target, you also have to question, to whose benefit are those amenities being, you know, to whose benefit do those amenities exist?
Right. Thank you. Josh, what are your thoughts on food gentrification as we transition into a post-pandemic condition?
You know, one of the most striking images, well, there's so many striking images from the pandemic. But one of the most striking images to me were images of sidewalk cafes in places like New York City and San Francisco, creating literal bubbles over tables that were quote unquote safe, preventing the spread of COVID-19, while at the same time, houseless people were living on those same streets, not being able to access basic foods. You know, we saw historic lines at food banks and food pantries. And it's sort of this discrepancy that reminds me of the fact that these shock moments can further create divisions between various classes and groups of people. And I think as we move out of this pandemic moment, you know, one of the questions I'm asking myself around food and urban space is, who's going to have a right to the sidewalks? Who's going to have a right to eat and be in these various places? And what's going to happen to all the people, all the workers in particular that were working in a sector, the restaurant sector in particular, that was hit so hard by the pandemic? I think at its peak, 1 in 4 jobs lost were restaurant workers. And as of August, this past August, more than 6 million restaurant workers lost their jobs. And a lot of these people work in a fairly precarious industry. Some are the working poor, or it's sort of a precarious working class position. And so one of the questions I've been asking myself is, where are these people going to work? Are restaurants going to come back? And then if so, who are the restaurants going to be feeding? And I think there are going to be a lot of the dynamics that we've all been talking about, especially as restaurants close. Are we going to have investors come in and buy up swaths of empty restaurants and storefronts and then replace those with more upscale options that that feed a wealthier group of people? Now, that's perhaps a more pessimistic reading of what might happen. You know, alternatively, maybe sectors like the restaurant industry will see an opportunity to improve wages and benefits, and maybe we'll have structural forms of investment or required living wages, or universal healthcare, or other things of that nature that shore up the working class and make it so that it's affordable to stay in these neighborhoods and to work in the restaurant sector, and that be a livable sector, a place that's not as exploitative as it's historically been. So I think the pandemic has created an opportunity to rethink certain aspects of the food system and who gets to be in urban places. And I would love for us to kind of think through what are some solutions to various forms of food gentrification that we've been discussing here today as well.
I'd love to do that as well. Who would like to take that on? You know, one of you, you know, what are some of the solutions that you have seen from, you know, maybe Josh, you could start by, you know, since you were the editor for, you know, one of the editors for this wonderful book, you know, how do you pull it all together and how have you seen, maybe you can share a story of where it's working, if there's such a thing.
I'll give one brief example actually from the edited volume and then pass it off here. But Annalena Hope Hasberg, she's based in Los Angeles, and she's been working with Community Services Unlimited, Inc. And this was the nonprofit that was started by the Black Panther Party in Los Angeles. And, you know, for those of you unfamiliar, the Black Panther Party, one of, you know, their famous slogans was survival pending revolution. And survival came in the form of all kinds of community support and mutual aid. But one of those was the Free Breakfast for Children program. And so, you know, community uplift through providing nourishment has always been important. And Community Services Unlimited is creating the Paul Robeson Community Wellness Center. And this is this dynamic community space that will house South LA's first organic produce market and a local food hub that's increasing access to healthy local food for the entire South Los Angeles community and create jobs and have things like commercial kitchens so that small food enterprises by people in that local community will be supported. And so it's a way to be thinking about how to keep community in place through these grassroots mutual aid strategies that really begin with the historic communities that live in those places, that hold a lot of the solutions and knowledge to stay in those places, and work collaboratively to kind of build the capital and gain access to the land to create successful projects.
Thank you. Antonio, you want to chime in?
Sure. Yeah. I think that kind of generally speaking, you know, as my sort of personal narrative attests to, I think that what we need to be seeing a lot more of is the linking of food and housing issues. And that means, you know, conceptually, like understanding the underpinning aspects that lead to injustices in either sort of sector, if you want to put it that way. But also, of course, practically in thinking about how do we actually link organizing around housing and around food. And one example that I can think of is an organization called Poder here in San Francisco. People organized to demand environmental and employment or economic rights. They have a longstanding history of community-based organizing around issues of housing. So for instance, when I mentioned in my early teens being involved in anti-gentrification work here, Poder was one of the main organizations involved in this anti-displacement coalition. But they also have helped to start an urban farm and have a program called the Urban Campesinos, where they have youth who are learning various aspects of agroecology and food sovereignty kinds of politics linked into issues of gentrification and anti-displacement, right? So they're training or sort of, you know, they call it formación in Spanish, but it basically means, you know, like getting people to understand their conditions of existence in linking to all these different issues in a very similar way, so that then action is not thinking about them in isolated terms. I think there's been a lot of efforts, well-meaning efforts, of course, to like to affect, you know, the unsustainable food system, or efforts to deal with, you know, like displacement in a sort of reactive way. But really to overcome gentrification, we need really strong movements that can shift the way that governance happens. And I think for that, we really need more sophisticated and sort of grounded analysis. And I do think, you know, there are also tools that come up when you start doing that work. So land trusts are a big example, right? The idea of a land trust is essentially coming down to decommodifying land and turning it from something that can be used as a speculative tool for profit making to serving the needs of people, right? And so land trusts can be urban land trusts for housing. They can be urban land trusts for agricultural land within the urban space. They can be rural land trusts for rural land. You know, they can serve a lot of functions. And one great example I like to give people, again, in the Bay Area, is the Segorite Land Trust, which is an indigenous woman urban land trust led to basically generate access to land for a federally unrecognized tribe in order to begin reconnecting to their traditional lands and practices. And that's something that may seem different than gentrification, but to me, the whole concept of decolonization and thinking about indigenous people continuing to exist and their leadership in addressing issues of food systems and housing and how do we treat land. These are all interconnected things. And so I think the land trust just is one sort of lens and tool to see how we can kind of point to a future society that doesn't rely on these private property notions that basically inherently, if we have them at the base of our society, we'll have things like gentrification.
And Justine, you want to share a bit?
Sure. So, you know, in hearing what Josh and Antonio were saying, it kind of brings me back to this concept of community resilience that I was talking about at the very beginning. And, you know, like I kind of indicated, my understanding of community resilience is not about adapting to conditions as they change externally, but really having a deeper understanding of the interrelated challenges and struggles that face urban communities and urban people. And so I think there are a number of organizations that see the food system as embedded in a series of other issues. So the food system as embedded in climate change, as embedded in housing conditions, health conditions, economic conditions. So, you know, I'm thinking of a couple of organizations across Pennsylvania. So there's the Black Urban Gardeners and Farmers of Pittsburgh. It's a convener of Black growers across the city. They grow food, share Black agricultural traditions. And, you know, similarly to some of the social service and mutual aid programs that the Black Panthers were running, Several decades ago, they distribute food, they educate youth and families. They also operate a large urban farm and work in the policy and advocacy arena. So I don't think that we can, you know, kind of like what we were talking about a few minutes ago, you can't see food and gentrification as separated into cultural spheres or political spheres or social spheres. You have to see all of these issues as very much interconnected and kind of embrace that complexity in a way that does work to decolonize urban space, to decolonize the knowledge and knowledge systems that we're accessing to engage with these issues so that we can draw upon the wealth of experience and knowledge and expertise that's embedded within communities, not just in the policy sphere or the university academic sphere.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So if my listeners, you know, who are listening want to get involved and try to, you know, join in the movement to look at these issues and to try to push back against some of the gentrification that's taking place, what are your suggestions? We don't have a lot of time, but if anybody could steer some of my listeners in a direction where they could be helpful, because one of the things I always do is trying to get people to take action, because we all need to do something. And so I'm sure this is resonating with some of my listeners. And where do you suggest they go with some of their energy?
I would say, first off, to involve communities, listen to people. Don't try to organize without collaborating with community members and community leaders. And that might be a little bit vague, but I would say as a very first step, this has to be a collaborative effort where processes are co-created with the people who are most deeply impacted by gentrifying processes.
Absolutely. I've seen that all across the food system. You know, that keeps coming up. You know, people with power coming in saying, this is what you need. And, you know, that without bringing the people who live there in. So,
also, Antonio? I think all on top of that is just do your research, right? So if you're in a new space that you haven't lived in previously, like actually find out what has been going on, who's been working on these issues, and seek to start the dialogues with those people rather than, you know, a lot of people assume, oh, I heard this great idea, I'm going to start an urban farm. You know, well, maybe there's other people already doing that and with different kinds of politics. Figure out who's out there and get involved with the thing that resonates with you and support existing endeavors before you think about starting your own. That's one other point.
Yeah. And Josh, you want to add something?
Maybe this is a way to think about what not to do. You know, don't prevent efforts that are going to improve lives of working class people. Don't oppose living wage laws. Don't oppose rent control laws. Like, don't oppose efforts that actually are going to level the economic playing field. And and especially when it comes to housing, I think, you know, if you own property, you have a structural desire to see that property increase in value. And then all of the other trickle down effects that come with that compel you perhaps to benefit from gentrification and the displacement of other people. And so, you know, it requires actually shedding some of those desires or some of those like hidden needs to act in solidarity with others. And so it's important to kind of think laterally and intersectionally, I think, as we've been talking about, to see where food is really entangled in all of these other processes. And at a minimum, don't be an obstructionist. And then
thank you.
Ideally find ways to work in community.
Thank you. Well, I want to thank all of you for your work. It's awesome. This has been a great conversation, something that we all really need to think about, because it's happening across the country and we need to really push back against it. So I want to thank you for your work. We are out of time. Everyone who's been listening to us, thank you so much for joining us. I've been talking with Josh Sabeka, Justine Lindemann, and Antonio Roman Alcala. And thank you all. And the book is A Recipe for Gentrification. I recommend you all get it and have a good read. And thanks again for joining me and everyone out there. Have a great rest of the week. And I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.
Thank you so much.
Bye, everyone.